Okay, so we haven't heard the conversation from your bench. Because of micro stakes, so we hear the black holes and black things.
Okay, so let me say, can everyone hear me? I never talk about my. So thank you to Rob and everyone else for inviting me. I'm going to tell you a little bit about a paper I wrote last May with Kara Berglund, who's a professor at UNH. And stuff that we're thinking about right now that's obviously going to be more speculative, but it's pretty interesting stuff. So the basic motivation here is this thing called the fuzzball conjecture, or the Mathur program, or whatever else you want to call it. I'll describe it in a couple of minutes. Offers what I think is a promising approach to the black hole information paradox. So the work that's been done up to this point has been focusing on these two charged microstates. These are in five dimensions. And these geometries classically represent black holes that have vanishing horizon area. Once you do stringing corrections, you can show that they have a small string size horizon, but we'd obviously like to do more interesting classical geometries. So we'd like to find geometries that can be microstates to these three charged black holes. In general, even though they're extremal, they'll have classically finite horizons. We also want to find microstates for these new solutions that have been found by a bunch of authors that are called black rings. I'll describe those a little more. In general, these are also going to represent just perfectly good, smooth, stable supergravity backgrounds that are new, which is always interesting in and of itself. We're also going to find that some ideas from quantum foam and geometric transitions kind of arise here. The difference here is that we'll find a quantum foam basically arising in a non-compact space, which is a new phenomenon, and I'll touch on that as well. So the basic outline is, I'll start out talking about just a rough description of what the fuzzball hypothesis is. Then I'm going to discuss this band of Warner ansatz, which they found a year or two ago for generally finding 1H BPS solutions to M theory that have three charges. Then I'll basically just start solving the equations in motion. So the sort of more technical parts would be on just solving the ansatz. Which I'll lay out, and then once I solve the ansatz of the equations of motion, that will basically guarantee everything locally. But I have to be aware of global concerns, things like closed time-like curves, horizons, global smoothness, stuff like that. So I'll have to lay out various conditions for those. I'll discuss an example or two, and then I'll just outline some various discussions of the general phenomenon. Okay, so the basic fuzzball hypothesis was put forward by Samir Mathur, various collaborators such as Oleg Lunin, and some of his students. And basically, what I have in the normal black hole picture is I have some central singularity, and then basically empty space, and then this line is supposed to be a horizon. I apologize for the fact that I only had X figures, so my figures are awful. So that's the basic general picture. And then you have Hawking radiation coming out of the horizon, and it's thermal in the normal sense, and so you have information loss. So the fuzzball hypothesis basically says that, forget about that, what I really have is some non-trivial physics going on all the way up here, and then some effective horizon. And the reason it's an effective horizon is that basically each of these microstates is completely smooth and horizon free, and they all do something interesting in here. And then out to here, once I'm past that, they all basically look the same. And go ahead.
I had a question. I mean, Schenker and collaborators have had this long program on looking behind the horizon
for
various black holes that I think are related to these by the coupling limit.
Sure.
And their horizon picture is kind of the bland one with singularity. Do you know what the relationship is?
I will. I'm about to describe it, actually. Okay, so the basic idea is, what's the relation between these two things? So the singular black hole geometry is basically seen as an emergent phenomenon. Basically what I'm doing is, think of a gas of particles in a box, right? Now I can characterize the specific quantum microstate of that gas of particles, right? But in general I care about more average questions, things like what's the pressure of the gas in the particle, what's the temperature? And to do that, I do statistical mechanics and I coarse grain and I get some ensemble. In this case, each of these microstates, while they may be different, right? Because out here, they all look the same. When I coarse grain, I take the ensemble geometry, I basically arrive at the singular geometry. So, go ahead.
Sorry, so in some sense, you consider the horizon to be, So to me, it seems that the horizon is an analog of a macroscopic quantity.
That's exactly right.
So it should be there even after you replace the sort of average spectrum with the microscale.
Well, let me, okay, so you agree that there is entropy associated with the horizon,
right? Yeah.
So you also agree that for a specific microscale, if I can specify it, it should have zero entropy.
If you wish, yes.
Right, so if I'm in a pure quantum state, I have zero entropy. So if I'm going to regard these geometries as pure quantum states, they, by definition, cannot have a horizon.
Okay, so but looking at it from a perspective of the metric, for example.
Sure.
In the classical solution, you have a metric where the time component approaches zero and there's a horizon. So is this going to be modified drastically in the...
Okay, so let's not talk about the time component, let's talk about the redshift factor, okay? Now, normally the redshift factor for a black hole is going to go up to infinity, right? Now, what you'll find for these geometries is that they'll go up to some very high point, and we can discuss how high that point is. That's something we haven't actually figured out yet, we're working on it right now. And then they'll basically cut itself off and just be smooth, so they won't actually go off to infinity. So what happens here is that this region here basically ends up being a very, very long throat. Okay, so I throw something in, and it goes down this long throat. Okay, and it takes a really, really long time to bounce around that throat and eventually come back out again. So for many experiments that you do, for example, if you just probe with like low energy things, you basically see a black hole. This isn't work that we've done, but work that's been done by other groups. Vijay Balasubramanian, Joan Simone, and these people have basically shown these, that for typical states you don't see a black hole. So that they were looking at half EPS geometries, but I think the idea carries through into EPS solutions. So I don't know that, does that answer your question at all?
Yeah.
This picture should be valid, however, large black hole is, right?
Yeah, so this is something
that means that the horizon could be as small as you like.
Yeah, so this is.
Why is the usual GR picture breaking down?
Well, okay, there's a couple things in that question. So I want to caution that this picture where interesting physics is happening up to the horizon has not explicitly been confirmed yet. Basically, the examples that have been done before we've done this were all for zero horizon black holes. So of course, any corrections you see are going to be out to the horizon. So we have what we think are the first microstates for, say, like a three-charge black ring of a small but finite horizon. What we have not done yet, and what we're doing right now, is analyzing for a generic microstate how far out do the corrections go. So I can't completely answer that question yet because we don't know the answer. But does that sort of get to what you're asking, or?
So you imagine that the effective spring scale at the horizon is much larger than the usual spring scale. I mean, if you say the usual spring scale is around the Planck.
I think that's. For the four-dimensional black holes that have been corrected, I think they find that. They find a large difference between the Einstein and string frame. If you look at these papers by Maloney and Hubini and company, they find that the horizon in string frame is very small, but in Einstein frame it becomes very large, precisely because the value of the dilaton that's fixed by the attractor mechanism at the horizon ends up being very large. So there's a large difference there when you worry about those.
Try and be more quantitative about this.
Yep.
You wanted to say that for a finite horizon area black hole, the thing was really a coarse grained version of many macroscopically distinct microstates.
Yeah.
I think that makes a sharp prediction, which is if you take the ABS-CFD dual with the thermal background.
Okay.
So you're right, that's a coarse grain of your classical.
Well, the problem is.
But you'd be predicting something very specific about the leading 1 over n fluctuations. You'd be saying that the thermal fluctuations are really huge.
Be careful when you say thermal fluctuations because we're working in the extreme black holes. So these are all zero temperature black holes.
Good. So I was extrapolating this picture to a finite horizon area hole and assuming that in fact the picture.
Well, these have finite horizon area even though they're extreme. They're still zero temperature.
I want finite temperature
and finite horizon. So that work has not been done yet. And I don't want to make any. The only papers that have been done on that are some papers by Simon Ross and collaborators. And they've just done the simplest solutions that classically, if they were extremal, would have zero horizon area, and they move a little bit away from the extremality. The other ones, the more general ones with finite horizon area and moving away, has not been explored yet. It's another thing we're thinking about. So I don't want to make any concrete predictions there, but I agree with you, that would definitely nail it down. So another thing we're looking at is, you'll see that we have this foam that was a non-compact space, and how far out that foam extends and makes a non-trivial geometry compared to where you think the horizon would be is something that we want to explore. So I think that would also nail it down. So we're not quite sure of the answer yet, but I think it would be a much bigger step towards making a quantitative understanding of this picture. Are there any more questions on this? All right, so just a general picture of what's going to happen. So I just said this, each minor state looks the same as entirely. Closer we see these differences. In our case, what we'll see is that where we think we have singular brain sources, we'll see a geometric transition occur, and we'll basically get a foam of two cycles that's flux starting through them. I'll do this in detail. I just want to, for the people that are going to fall asleep, I want to advertise now. So this geometry of these two cycles will basically determine which microstate we're in, and then there are going to be various rules for arranging these cycles that depend on things like closed time-like curves and, you know, global smoothness and stuff like that. So I'll very specifically lay out the conditions later on. So let's start by just writing down the Ben O'Loughran analysis. So this is an old paper a couple years ago by Ben O'Loughran. And basically what I'm going to do is I'm going to start in M theory. The reason I'm going to work in M theory is it treats all three charges equally and symmetrically, and it's just much easier to deal with in terms of solving equations of motion. If you want to get to the normal 2D picture, you just make one of the tori that I'm wrapping small, and then you do a couple, you do three T dualities in the normal V1, V5 picture. If people want to see that afterwards, I can show you how to do it, but I'm not going to do it right now. So basically what I'm going to do is I'm going to have three stacks of M2 brains. And each charge is going to be coming from wrapping the various T2s. Okay? So those are going to be my three charges. So basically, I have a non-trivial five-dimensional space, that's this DT, this K, and this hyperkaler, and then this six-dimensional thing. And then the torus is just parameterized by these C functions. So there's a couple things I want to call attention to. The first is, there's this non-trivial time vibration. This K is a one-form that has legs in all the hyperkaler directions. And so this non-trivial time vibration becomes very important later on. The next thing is that this hyperkaler metric, I'm going to write in Gibbs Hawking form, and I'm actually going to allow this thing to switch signature, so long as this function in front of it behaves in such a way that the overall 11-dimensional metric is well-defined, smooth, and a constant signature. And then the C field, which sources this, is just given by this. I want to point out that it's always, the C field always has two legs on one of the tori. These are the Z, little Z directions. And so when I reduce on T6, I basically end up with 3V1 gauge fields. So all the charges I discuss are going to be basically charged up in these 3V1s. So,
can I actually ask you a question about this?
Sure.
You know, this, you were to say that if ds squared hk switches line, but the cube root of z1, z2, z3 switches line,
yes,
everything's fine. But then, does the t6 metric remain with good solves?
Yeah. I'm gonna ensure that everything works. Yeah, because look, you see the t6 metric?
Yeah.
Basically, where z1, z2, z3 switches sign?
Yeah.
Each of the Z's will also switch sign, and so the overall thing will switch.
You'll never be one.
Exactly. The overall metric will be completely smooth, and we're going to have to be very careful to ensure that.
Yeah.
It's going to control these Z functions. So if I basically just define these G's to be the D's and these little A's that show up in the C field, then Ben and Warner show that in general you have a 180 BPS solution as long as you satisfy these equations. Basically, I need my gauge field to be self-dual, and then the Laplacian of these ZIs has to obey this equation, and the self-dual part of this K form has to obey this. You might think that this allows you to add an arbitrary anti-self-dual part to K, and in a sense that's true at the level of the equations in motion, but if you don't add corresponding pieces to the other things, you'll find you get closed timeline curves. So that's another thing we'll have to be careful of. And then this SIJK is basically just, I'm sick of writing absolute epsilon JK. It's just, if you see this, it means GJ and GK in such a way that it's not high, but there's no signs there. It's just completely symmetric. So let's start solving the equations of motion. So I have this hyperkaler metric. I'm going to allow the pseudo hyperkaler condition, as I call it. And then I'm just going to write the metric in Gibbs-Hawking. So basically, I'm going to find some harmonic function, H inverse and sigma squared. The sigma is a one form. It's basically defined by its equation of motion, which is the three-dimensional Hodge rule of its derivative has to be related to H. And then I basically have some work factor, again, H times just a basic R of 3. You can write this in various coordinate systems, but I choose to write it this way. And there's a period of tau. So what we're going to find is that our general solution will be included by 8 harmonic functions on this R of 3. So all this physics that looks complicated in M-theory and everything is basically going to just amount to doing physics in R3 and nothing else, and very simple harmonic functions. So let me see, is it working? This H is basically what controls the given talking. In terms of physical quantities, if I were to compactify in 4 dimensions, this would be like the D6 frame monopole charge. This little hi is basically going to control the D5 brain dipole charge. I'm going to arbitrarily choose to make no D5 brain net charge in infinity, but it's going to be some magnetic dipole charge. These big MIs basically will parameterize the M2 brain charge, and this K will in some sense parameterize the angular momentum. I'll go through each of these in detail. So are there any questions on this kind of general setup? Okay, so start with the easiest thing, the function H. Now, normally, if I didn't allow it to switch signs, I'd have, so H is basically the sum over NP, over RP, where RP is just basically separating out the poles. And then this condition that the sum of the NPs equals 1 basically guarantees that asymptotically I have an R4. If not, I'll have some R1 plus S3 mod something, which you can do, but I choose not to do it here. Now, normally, I would have H if it was just, you know, if H had to be greater than 0 everywhere, then it's kind of boring, because I could basically just pick 1 over R, and I would get nothing else, because I can't cancel it off, and you'll end up with just the normal metric. But since I'm allowing these n's to be positive and negative, I can do more interesting things. So basically, I'll divide my metric, my R3 into regions where H is greater than 0, H is less than 0, and a domain wall where H equals 0. So this domain wall was the initial motivation for doing this problem. We thought it was mainly going to be something like an Hansom locus. What you find is that it's actually not. It's just an ergosphere. Nothing special really happens there, at least as far as we can tell with brain probes. Although I still think something's going on there, but we're not quite sure yet. While the hyperkeller metric is singular there, basically this overall time vibration will keep everything smooth. And you'll verify that.
Are there any large curvatures?
It depends on the nature of your solution. So the solutions I'm going to write down, the curvatures will be controlled by like a parameter, and you can tune that parameter. But certainly if there's large curvatures, I worry about shitty corrections. So you have to be careful there. OK, so this is where you can see these two cycles now. So if I go back to the R3, is there an eraser? Can everyone see if I write over here? These two cycles are a little confusing. So here's my R3, right? I'm going to pick two points, P and Q, which are poles of this function, okay? Now, when they're poles of this function, if I go back to the hyperkeller metric, you see that the sigma fiber degenerates. Basically, H inverse goes to 0. And so what happens is, let me draw a line here, is that the radius of the sigma of the tau coordinate, say, is like this over here, and here it goes to 0, and here it goes to 0. So this is basically forming a two-cycle in a somewhat confusing way. Okay, but there's the two-cycle. So basically, this H function is going to control the placement of these two cycles in the geometry.
You never consider the case where you add a constant to H?
I will. I don't know if I get to it in this talk. If you add a constant to H, it's basically putting in a tau nut background, and that's how you compactify the 4 dimensions. So I don't think I discussed it in this talk. There's subtle modifications to various equations I'll write down. If you're interested, I can certainly discuss it with you afterwards. I mean, we worked it out, and I can show you the details of it. Just in the interest of time, I haven't done it because this is the case. Okay, so these dipole fields are basically the M5 brain charge. And basically, the way you read off the M5 brain charge is you take, you know, the derivative of the gauge field, take its dual, and then you read off the legs in the time direction. If you do that, if you look back at the form I have, the proportional to these GI functions, and then I basically need these to fall off with my way of infinity, like 1 over r. And then you also need to ensure that these GIs have no similarities except that h equals 0. That's basically going back to the smoothness question. If you do that, basically you find that, GI has this form to satisfy the equations of motion, where I define, as I said, this new harmonic function, where these DIs are like dipole charges, and then this force is for normalization. Now this choice that the sum of these DIPs is equal to 0, this is a gauge choice. Again, I'm going to work throughout in this gauge, but you can easily see how to change it. Basically, what it corresponds to is, you look at this form of GI, I can always add a little bit of h on to little hi without changing the gauge field, and that'll basically shift this sum of d's. And then there's some integer quantization role on that that I'll get to later. This is just very simple. I'm just defining these various quantities. There are a lot of things like all the r's written down together. And if you see a pi r, it means all the r possibles. If you see a subindex on that, it just means it's all the r's except for that one, and so on. And this f function is basically just the sum of all the np's times all the r's except the r of that pole. And if you work it out, it should be written that way. Now, the other, the truly fundamental quantity here is these, what I wanted to find is these relative dipoles. You take all the d's that I just defined then and just say it's np diq minus nq dip. You can rewrite everything in terms of that. And what you'll find is that this dipq actually parameterizes the flux to the various u1s through each two-cycle. So the pq labels which two-cycle it's going through, and the I will label which u1 is charged up. But that parameterizes the various fluxes through these two-cycles. And those are going to be basically the only quantities you have to worry about is the placement of these two-cycles, the residue at each pole, which will control certain orbital folds, and then the flux through it, and that's it. And then I can basically read off the asymptotic charges of the three D2 brains or M2 brains. They work out to basically be this, which is related in terms of the flux. So like I said, every quantity that I can think of can basically be rewritten in terms of these DPQs, except for the angular momentum, because that's coming from a flux vector. The monopole fields goes in a pretty similar way, except that we want net M2 brain charge. So if you look at C3, basically the ZI is encoded using the three membrane charges. To get the right membrane charge, you basically want these ZIs to go like 1 plus QI over 4R, which is harmonic. But the problem is that that doesn't quite satisfy the equations of motion. So you basically define the part that you want it to go like, and then you correct to satisfy the equations of motion. And this QIP you can think of as a little bit of fractional M2 brain charge at each pole in the R3, and then basically I sum up to get the overall charge. So I know this is a little bit technical right here, but really I'm just doing stuff. Yeah.
Just intuitively, once you thread these things with fluxes,
yep.
I would guess that would make the two spheres want to expand. So what's the counterbalancing force?
You'll see. Let me show I'm about to show what I call the bubble equation, and that should explain it. It's not quite increasing the d's, because there's terms that are quadratic and terms that are cubic, and they balance out, and signs are important. So the angular momentum is basically defined by this one form k. The natural thing to do is to split it up into a part on the sigma fiber and a part on the R3. Don't worry about the details of this ansatz, except for the fact that I have to define this new harmonic function k, and it's part of the function k bar. That's, again, just going to be a harmonic function. I have some quantities, which I don't know yet, LP over RP. And then this basically is the correction to satisfy the equations of motion. You want to ask a question?
No.
So we want k basically to be regular, globally defined, and it better only have singularities where h equals 0. So if there's singularities anywhere else, there's a singular term in the metric. If there's singularities where h equals 0, I can cancel it off with the z functions, which is, in fact, what exactly will happen. And I need it to fall off like 1 over r asymptotically, otherwise I have an infinite angular momentum in infinity, which is a problem. So we can do this by basically, I can always add a closed form to k, a, k, x, a. And then I can basically demand this. So this, I'm going to write out this equation in more detail. This is going to be the main equation controlling the various fluxes and stuff like that. So the first condition, this one, basically removes these poles in k bar. You'll see that the way I define k bar, there's going to be poles in general for this part. So I'm basically going to redefine k such that any pole here is canceled off by a pole here. So I'm going to get subleading contributions. And then this term is a little bit more subtle. Basically what happens is, if I go back to this equation, so I want d squared of something, it better be zero, if it's a well-defined globally, if it's a globally well-defined one form, right? So I don't need to start defining things in patches. D squared of it better be zero, right? So d squared of this, if I take the star three of this equation and compute the d, basically gives me this right-hand side. If you work out what this is carefully, you'll basically find it's a top form times a delta function times k0. And so when you integrate that, it basically gives you k0 at that point. Okay? That had better vanish. If it doesn't, then I have to worry about the fact that my form is not well defined. So that's what this condition is basically doing. If you work it out, here's what it comes out to be. After a lot of algebra that's kind of annoying. The sum of these DIPs is basically fixed by this formula. So I have to make sure that how I arrange these things and the angle, this RPQ is basically the separation between them, is parameterized in such a way that this equation is always satisfied. So if you work out the number counting, this puts n minus 1 constraints in the relative pole position. So I have n poles, I have n minus 1 constraints. So I still have 1 at 2 degree of freedom. So does that answer your question, Shami?
I think so. You're saying that actually what prevents one sphere from expanding is that it makes a different sphere smaller?
Yeah.
And that sphere is being,
Yeah, basically, the spheres all kind of push on each other.
Yeah.
And one of them can't get like so big relative to the other one unless it's compensated for by a change in flux.
You have to decrease the flux for the guys that are now small.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's what it comes out to be.
Good.
Okay, this is basically just if you want to write off the angular momentum. Basically, the easiest way to do it is you can separate it into self-dual and anti-self-dual parts, basically because the angular momentum gauge group, not the gauge group, sorry, the angular momentum group, right, I'm on R3, so I have SO4, which I can rewrite as SU2 left cross SU2 right, and so I can just talk about J left and J right. If you work it out, just by writing down the Euler forms and reading off the asymptotics, JL basically comes out to be dependent upon this dipole moment. The important thing to point out is that JL is dependent not just on the charges, but actually on the relative arrangement of the two cycles. So I can keep the same JR, but I can say adjust the positions of these two cycles or their relative arrangement. And I could get back to a different JL. The reason JR is not dependent upon the two cycles is because I'm working with U1 invariant geometries. Basically, as soon as I chose to write things in given talking form and not make things a function of tau or sigma, I've picked that out as an isometry of my spacetime. So the general geometry will not do that. And you'll find that JR is dependent, but that's just much harder to deal with, so we haven't dealt with it yet.
So, can you remind me what capital D is again?
Sure. It's basically the global dipole moment. It's right here.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. It's basically the vector sum. One other little tidbit, if anyone's actually specialized in this, is that you can decide whether you want these to be integer quantized or half integer quantized. It's just a question of normalization. So that's why, if you're confused, these are integer quantized. You want to match up to like what math and company are doing, just divide everything by two. Okay, so that basically solves the equations of motion. And if I only cared about local geometry, that's all I'd have to do. But I need to consider things like smoothness and closed time on curves and stuff like this. So what we'll find is that these put further constraints on relative pole location, the charges, the dipole charges. So the natural thing to check, the first thing to check is, well, I said this h equals 0 is where things start blowing up. Well, if you actually do the algebra and you work it out, you find actually the C field and the metric are completely smooth at h equals 0. It actually doesn't even put any further constraints in the poll conditions. Just basically like picking the ansatz the way I did, and picking the various functions to only have singularities when h equals 0, ensures that everything cancels off in a nice way. So I'm not going to do the algebra here. It's just kind of ugly. It doesn't really do anything. But if people want to see it, I can do it. The next thing you don't have to worry about is, well, you want the metric to be completely regular, and you want it to be singularity free. So certainly something you have to worry about is if the determinant switches sign or goes through 0 or goes through infinity, except where you have like a polar coordinate origin, you're going to have problems. Right? If you compute the determinant, it works out to be something very simple. It's just a regular R3 determinant, this h function, and then z1, z2, z3 to the 1/3. You better make sure now that z1, z2, z3 to the 1/3 times h doesn't go through 0 and doesn't change sign. So the easiest way to do that, it turns out, is just to say that each zi times h equals 0. Basically because each of these zi's is basically the same, except they're different in ones. So you demand that zi h is greater than 0. You work out what this condition is. It comes out to be this somewhat ugly thing. And as long as you satisfy this, you'll always make sure that your metric is completely smooth and regular. Next, close timeline curves.
Sorry, I missed something stupid. Sure. Zi switch sign that are always not zero, they're just continuities? Or?
Zi goes through sign. And Zi goes through sign and go through zero.
So, okay, so you do have singularities. They're just at specified points.
No. If you look at the overall metric, it's always like the appropriate z function times h.
Oh, I see.
Terms in the metric will go to zero. For example, the dt squared term goes to zero on the domain wall, but that's just because it's an ergo equation. There's still a cross term that saves you the overall signature of the metric.
And with respect to your second criteria, h has a pole or something?
Yeah, because where z blows up, h also blows up. Or sorry, where z blows up, h goes to zero, and they count that.
Yeah. Maybe where z vanishes.
Yeah, where z vanishes.
Where z vanishes, h blows up, and where h vanishes, z blows up in such a way that it's always finite.
Right.
So you said that it is smooth, but is there some constraint that you have small curvatures?
Well, again, this is just the general ansatz. For the specific examples you do, you have to worry about the order of magnitude of the curvatures. So I'm going to do an example later on. I don't actually explicitly calculate the curvature, but it'll be controlled by some parameter I write down. And so you have to then question if your solution is valid, you know, if it's in the right regime. So it's going to depend example by example as opposed to this. So this is, again, only super graph. Right, I haven't done anything in terms of string correction. So you do have to keep that under concern. Does that answer you, or?
Well, you'll show the example.
Yeah. If you're still confused after I do the example, you know, just let me know here. Okay, so I wanted to exclude closed timeline curves. So obviously there's not going to be any closed timeline curves on the T6, that's completely trivial. Now the five you reduce space there can be. So the easiest way to do this, and the most general way to do this, is to demand something called stable causality. This is an old Hawking and LSTR thing. What it basically amounts to is that I need a globally defined smooth function, basically that has a timeline gradient everywhere. Okay, and that is what I'm going to call the time function. The most obvious thing to pick is just the coordinate t. You work out its gradient, it's just gtt. So that better be, which is this, and that better be greater than zero. Okay, this is not a nice function. Okay, for example, this KAKB for a general setup that I'm going to do is not simple. It's complicated, and showing that this is greater than zero everywhere is really hard. So for a couple examples, we did this numerically, or we just kind of hope that it works. So some of the examples that I'll do is modulo this constraint, and this should be kept in mind. So if anyone can come up with a nice simple way of analyzing this, I'd love to talk to you, because we've been struggling with it for a while, and we just haven't come up with a good way of looking at it. One nice thing I'll point out, though, is that you see this, if I knock off this GR3 term and set this to zero, this thing right here is actually the E77 quartic invariant of the new development. Why that's showing up there, I don't know. It's something very interesting. Also, the Z1, Z2, Z3, I think, is the quadratic E6 invariant. So I don't know why it's showing up. But it's certainly interesting that things like demanding the E77 quartic invariant is greater than zero are important. But then there's this annoying little other term on there. So I don't really know why it's there, but I don't know how to control it. So food for thought if people are cleverer with group theory than I am. Okay, Horizons actually turned out to be, as soon as you insert a no closed element curve, it actually follows. One reason to know there's no horizons is, well, except for orbital pole points, I have no curvature singularities, and it'd be pretty surprising if you found something like an event horizon without a singularity inside of it. But we still want to check explicitly. So how do I do it? I want to make sure that from any point, I can always get, I can find a time-like geodesic that goes out to infinity. So if I look at the vector dr, its norm is basically this, which works out to be minus gtt. And it's positive everywhere as long as there are no CTCs. If you consider this vector field, sorry, GRR is not minus GTT. It's greater than or equal to minus GTT because I don't have the other parts coming up. And remember, I just ensured that minus GTT is greater than 0. So GRR is definitely greater than 0. If I write down this vector field and I compute its norm, it's basically minus GRR, which is a negative, times 1 minus epsilon squared. So basically, if I pick epsilon to be less than 1 but greater than 0, then the vector is always time-like and I always get out to infinity. So I have no horizons as long as there's no closed element curves. Okay, interesting topology issues here. So I said before this R3 metric has orbital points for the identifications on the sigma fiber. Now, this is the normal Hopf vibration. So the easiest way to calculate the topology is let's just look at the R3. Right, because sigma is sigma was equal to d tau plus something on the R3, right? And there's a sphere in this R3, so there could be a non-trivial vibration there. And basically, if you work it out, it ends up just counting the number of poles inside the sphere you're drawing, inside the three sphere that you're drawing. So basically, if the total number of poles is 0, then your topology is S2 cross S1. If it's 1, then it's S3, and if it's any other integer, it's some orbital of S3 in the normal way. You can then check, I did this in the regular R3 because it's easier to do, but you can check that it actually doesn't get corrected in the full metric. Next, let's make sure there's no Dirac strains in the geometry. So let's say I have a probe membrane, and I'm going to actually use an M2 brain so I get the right tension and charge. If I basically wrap it on the torus, then I basically just have a charged particle in 5 dimensions with this charge, basically the volume of the torus times the tension of the M2 brain. And then this gauge field is just coming from reducing the C3 field on the T6. Now you have to worry about, as I said, there are these two cycles in the geometry. And basically, I want to make sure that as I go around any loop of those two cycles, I don't pick up a phase in my wave function. The other subtlety is that because these are orbital points, I have to work at the universal couple, right? Because everything's valued in NP or NQ, so I have to actually multiply this by NP and Q, so this factor is coming from. And if you work it out, it actually ends up being something very simple. It's just the charge of the membrane times the flux through that two cycle. So this is telling me that the flux through the two cycle is basically integer quantized in some appropriate units. And this is just within the supergravity, although it's not really within the supergravity because I'm using the fact that I know the attention of the M2 brain probes. There's another cycle, though. Remember this, basically my R4 geometry near one of these poles is basically some cone over S3 mod Zn, right? It's Znp, which is right here. And so I have to make sure as I go around that I don't also pick up a phase. And if you work that out, basically it just comes out to be the phase around the point P has to be integer quantized, and again I pick up an NP because it's orbifolded. And so what that tells me is that each of the DIPs, which you can use to construct the fluxes, that better also be integer quantized. If you work that out, this requirement actually forces you to satisfy this requirement. So they're not completely independent. And if you work it out, you'll find that it also basically quantizes the membrane charge, although not in a simple way. You'll see I have integer times integer over integer times integer, so I can have fractional charge. But then it's summed over P and Q, so it usually ends up becoming an integer. But this allows me to basically distribute the brains in some fractional way, which is starting to look like a geometric transition. So let me just summarize for anyone who's asleep, which is probably half the people. All this complicated stuff in all this technical analysis is basically just parameterized by this flux to the two cycles, which is now integer quantized in these units. And then I just have to satisfy these three conditions. This one is basically demanding that everything is well defined globally. This one ensures that my space-time is smooth, and this one ensures that I have no closed time that occurs. So I'm going to do an example after this, but are there any questions at this point? This is a good, people are confused about that. We're doing on time. So let's do a simple three-pole example. So the two-pole solutions have actually already been done. All of these solutions that Mater and other people write down, there are these spectral flows of these two charge states. So they have these three charge states, but they're always representative of black holes with zero horizon area. These are all just reduced to two-pole solutions. So we do this in our paper. I'm not going to redo this. You can basically hook it up to the component string language and the CFT. It's interesting, but it's already been done. The simplest three-pole scenario, which is the one I'll focus on, is let's just imagine H has two poles with plus one residue and one pole with minus one residue. Because these things are one and minus one, I don't even have orbital poles here. The solution is completely and totally smooth within supergravity. And then the next thing to do is I want to choose dipoles that are diagonal with 3U1s. The reason I'm doing that is they have to all be parallel to match up to what people have done for the black rings. I want to try to match this to a black ring solution. So I just choose the D's to do this. If you work out that condition for K to be globally defined, that bulb equation, it just tells you that R13 and R23 are basically just D squared over 12. So this D, to answer your question, is the parameter that will control how big the cycles are and also control like what the curvature scales are. So by tuning D, you can make the curvature scales arbitrarily small or large as you choose.
Everywhere in space, or
yeah. So there'll be some maximum curvature scale, and it'll be set by D. I haven't actually explicitly calculated it, but it's set by D to some power, possibly over some number. And you can work out what that is. I think it's probably proportional to D squared or something like that. And so by tuning D, you can choose what your largest curvature scale is to be. That's only true for this example. Of course, more complicated examples, it won't just be D, it'll be something more complicated.
In this explicit example, could you check that there are no closed time-like curves?
We checked in certain directions, and we verified. For example, you can check along the sigma phi whether or no, and in certain angles in R3. But in general, we haven't been able to show it. No path that we've written down is like a closed time-like curve. But, you know, that's not... There's an infinite number of paths you can think of. So we haven't found a good general way of writing it down.
How about horizons? Because
there's no horizons.
Yeah, so that can prove rigorously.
Well, I mean, there's no curvature singularity, so why would you expect there to be horizons?
Well, you can trivially write down gravity solutions which have naked singularities, so I don't see how that one thing can...
Well, yeah. What I'm saying is I can't think of a solution that has an event horizon that doesn't also have a singularity. So this solution has no singularities. So I'd be pretty surprised that there was an event horizon including a non-singular region.
But you don't want to beat the curvature.
No, the curvature is finite everywhere. There's two issues here. The curvature does not blow up. But whether the curvature is string scale or not is tunable by the D. But it doesn't blow up unless you set D to infinity. Right. So it's always finite. So there's no singularity in terms of supergravity. He's asking the question about whether you can trust the supergravity limit. And that's a question that you have to determine various radius and curvatures and stuff like that.
But we have to be explicit in the curvature.
Sure, but it shouldn't be that tough to do. I mean, I can write it explicitly in the new
computer. So I lost track of notation. Are your D's quantized?
These D's are basically, okay, so remember I had DIP was integer quantized? And then I'm basically just saying that all my DIPs are just D, and then one of them is minus two.
And the curvature gets large or small as you send D to infinity?
I think it gets large as you send D.
So then there's a non-trivial question, because D has the smallest possible value of the little one rolling.
So this equation, which we have checked, that ZIH is greater than zero, this we checked analytically at various places, and then numerically everywhere. This is satisfied, so it's completely regular. So let me draw the setup. Okay, I really need to get into a deal with dinner, I apologize. So the setup here is that, let's see, I place pole 3 at the origin, and then I place pole 1 on the z-axis, and then I place pole 2 somewhere here, and I'm going to call this angle here psi. And basically what you find is that by tuning psi, I can basically alter this dipole moment and I can alter JL. So what you find is that as I vary psi, it looks like I can match microshapes with black rings and finite size horizon area. And again, modulo the CDC division. I want to caution here, there's two issues. First of all, reading off, comparing these solutions to the black ring solutions is difficult because the entropy in various charges to the black rings, like JL, for example, is written in terms of the ring radius, which is what the horizon is. Since we don't have a horizon here, it's difficult to actually pin down. What we basically did is various ratios of quantities where the horizon, where the radius of the ring horizon drops out, those match. The other thing to worry about is that the black ring has the dipoles aligned along the ring axis. And in this case, they won't be, right? Because, say, this defines the ring axis, and this defines the dipoles. So by moving this closer, I can get it to align. But as I move it closer, you'll see that as psi decreases, basically, you'll find that what you think is the effective horizon also decreases. So there's some tuning that goes on there.
So you have a set. So you have a class of solutions which are parameterized by psi.
Yes.
Is psi a modulus?
Okay. This is another thing I want to. So at this point, psi is a modulus because I haven't done any quantization, right? This is all classical. So really, I have to quantize this thing, and in that case, it's not clear if psi is continuous and I have some wave function on psi space, or psi can only take integer values. So the reason I'm confused about that is people are not quite sure what ensemble to take for the black hole. If you read some literature that's coming from topological string people, it seems to be some kind of mixed ensemble. It's not exactly the canonical, it's not the microcanonical. So it's a little bit unclear. So at the classical level, psi is definitely continuous. But I think when it's quantized, either only certain values of JL will come out, or you'll find some like wave function on the JL moduli space.
What happens if you add a small finite temperature to your solutions?
I don't know.
Do you think they kind of collapse dramatically because they're kind of degenerate?
I honestly don't know, and I don't want. We're actually considering, and I don't know what the answer is. So I don't have any intuitive grasp of what happens if you add finite temperature to this at this point. So. Ask me again in like 3 months, and maybe I'll be able to tell you. Juliana?
You were talking about, what are you talking about? I like dipoles by taking psi to zero.
Yeah.
Why don't you take psi to, or does something special happen if psi goes to pi and it turns on JL? Is that?
So there are also, not all values of psi are actually allowed, because, as you tune psi, you might not be satisfying various other requirements like triangle inequalities. So I can't remember what the exact range on psi is, but I think pi is not allowed. Okay. I think you can't actually take J, because you're going for the BMDB black hole, of course. So this is not going to be the microstate for the BMDB black hole. And that's something to be expected, because the generic microstate is going to have a lot of poles, right? A lot of these two cycles. And by adding more, we think we'll be able to tune in to get JL 0 or close to 0. I don't think you'll ever be like a JL is actually equal to 0, because there's always this little bit that's added on when you actually take into account the Fermi on 0 modes. So it probably won't go completely to 0. So that's actually my next slide. So, okay, first, I'll just summarize. We've seen that basically where we thought we had singular brain sources and a naked singularity and a horizon, instead we have this nice picture of a geometric transition where this foam of non-compact two cycles basically shows up. This starts to look like things like melting crystal space-time foam and stuff like that. What's different here is, as I said before, these cycles actually live in the non-compact space. So all the other examples I've seen, they always live in the compact space. So that's kind of nice and a new phenomenon. There's probably some connection here between the two pictures, but we're not quite sure what it is yet. Principally because my knowledge of topological constraints consists of knowing there's A and B models. That's probably about it. Another interesting thing is, remember, by allowing this thing to be pseudo-hyperkeller, these NPs can be positive and negative. And I said before that these are basically like D6 brain charge in four dimensions. And so I basically am adding brains and new brains, yet it's still super symmetric. And the way you can get around that is because I have flux. So by adding flux, and some of which, I mean, knows this very well, you can have things that would normally be non-supersymmetric. But because of that, basically what happens is brains that are anti-aligned because of the flux effectively flips the brain around, so they look parallel again. So this is another interesting phenomenon. And to sort of go on what Rob was asking, the higher order solutions, which we haven't completely done yet, basically because the equations just get really hard to solve, we need to think of a good way to organize the computation, which is what we're working on now, should be generic microstates for black holes and black rings. That's a conjecture. I can't prove it yet, but it's reasonable to assume.
Question?
Sure.
I think spheres are pinned down at these locations you pointed out, right?
Yeah.
In what sense is this troubling solution?
I mean, well, because I expect by altering fluxes and stuff, I can keep basically the same conserved charges, but have different arrangements of spheres of different sizes and stuff. Also, this is, of course, static, right? Because I'm in the BPS limit. So as Shami was asking, if you turn on my temperature effects, it's possible these spheres can evolve and move around and do stuff like that. You're not going to see any dynamics because I'm working on a BPS solution.
Yeah, okay.
So there's, I mean, it's, in order to maintain the fact that it's super symmetric, I have to be in the static limit.
No, yeah.
Well, no, it's okay. I only have one slide left, so.
No, no, I was thinking of this lady learning Madison picture. You have some plane and you can, you know, you can have different.
Yes, so this is certainly more. This is more restricted than that.
Yeah, okay.
They have, I mean, there's a half BPS solution and that's not the ADS space. So, I mean, it's going to be very different. There's certainly parallels here because basically we're defining everything in the three plane and arrangements of various quantities in the three plane determine the entire solution.
But here, the only thing that you have is just the B number through.
No. I can change the series, right? I can. I mean, there are different possible configurations. The example I did was just arbitrarily picking various ends and d's, right? I can add poles, I can change the ends, I can change the d's in such a way that I can get a more general configuration, right? That's just the simplest thing. So there's much more complicated things you can do. You can do a 422 pole case. You know, it's entirely possible. Okay. Yeah.
So you have this various configuration. Do you see something like a stretched horizon emerging?
Yes, this is what I was referring to now, because the reason we haven't computed that yet is we haven't really found what we consider to be a good generic macrostate yet. So, I mean, this three-pole case is obviously highly specialized, and even the three-pole case I just picked is highly specialized. We can do other ones, too. So I don't know if it's a good idea to compute what we think would be the stretched horizon for that example. Yeah, I think you'd want to go to a higher pole case and a more generic arrangement.
Is there a good argument why a generic microstate should be described by supergravity rather than a state that has large curvatures?
No. What I would say is that the generic microstate could be in either of those two classes, and I think some of them will fall into the supergravity limit, and some of them will be required to be described in terms of string theory. So I'm certainly not claiming that we found all microstates for the three-charge black hole. I want to make that clear. But I think it's become a good class of microstates. I don't know how to deal with the ones that can only be in terms of distributed geometry, or even something that doesn't have a geometrical interpretation. I just don't know how to deal with that. So I'd rather nail down these states and understand them well, and understand maybe what coarse grading these things means, and then worry about these other states.
But before you coarse grade them, you have to quantize them. You have to have discrete indices on this microstate. At this stage, you have continuous parameter.
Well, the only thing that I have continuous is this angle, sorry. But I will point out that if I fix JL, psi is not continuous anymore. For a given JL, there's only one psi that works out to be the right thing. So if I fix all the conserved charges, right, there's only one solution within this example. Right, so here, I'll go back. So you see, I have, so Q is set by this, JR is set by this. If I fix the value of JL, there's no freedom in psi anymore. Varying psi takes me to different angular momentum solutions. So if you consider these to be conserved charges, then only one of these exists for each conserved charge for this example. But as I said before, the sum that's done for the black hole partition function, it's not yet clear if these should be quantized or there should be some kind of, it's not clear if you want to sum over states of microstates that have fixed JR and JL, or you want to sum over states that have variable JR and JL with some Lagrange multiplier in the partition function.
So
But is there an argument why, say, J L should be quantifier? I guess maybe, I'm sorry, maybe you let.
Well, okay, there's a couple arguments. The first is, if I'm trying to match this up to a CFT state, which, by the way, is not clear. It's not clear that every one of these matches up, that there's a one-to-one mapping between geometries and CFT states. Then those have quantized JL, little JL, right? Which is basically a big JL times some appropriate, you know, dimensional numbers. So those look quantized. So why would this be quantized?
Are your states one of the, for this example that you showed, is this a state you can identify in this year?
No, only for the simple states that you're able to identify them. Because those are the static flow states. The general free charge state will be more complicated, and we're working on identifying it, but we have not nailed it down yet.
Are there more general free pole solutions than this?
Yes. Yeah. I just did this because it's a
simple. Yeah, that's what I know.
Yeah.
Actually, now I'm confused by your answer to Alex's question a little bit. If you think that JL will end up being quantized because, for instance, you know, all match CFT states.
Mm-hmm. I actually don't think that.
You don't think that?
No.
But supposing that were true, because these aren't all known CFT states.
Right.
What possibly could happen if in the regular solutions you quantize the fluxes in the way.
Oh, I think there are certain CFT states that have the right quantum numbers, but don't have a good geometric interpretation in terms of supergravity.
So you just think there should be more CFT states than these?
Yes.
Think all these should be CFT states?
Yes, yes.
So would you say that?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, that's all
these. So would you? So the solution, at least this class of solutions that you found, you don't have any modulus at all. So somehow in the geometry that you constructed, you fixed all the moduli.
Well, the moduli here would be the conserved charges.
Well, yeah, so if I say that I keep them fixed, then there are no moduli in your.
Well, okay. I'm not sure what you mean by moduli, because I can, for example, I should be able to write down solutions that have the same conserved charges, but have different, you know, arrangements of these G-spheres. But still give the same overall concept.
Just the discrete choices. But I'm saying, right, your different arrangements are the, I thought that they correspond to discrete choices, right? How you distribute the total fluxes.
Well, no, but let's, for example, let's say I can come up with a 27 pole state that has the same conserved charges as this 3 pole state, right? Mm-hmm. Then, I mean, all the moduli, I would argue, are the choices of all the positions of the various 27 G-cycles.
And if I'm asking something much more simple, so the solutions that you have, like the three-pole, the three-pole solution, so in those solutions there are no, from the supergravity perspective, there are no moduli, is that correct?
I think so, although I'm slightly confused by your question, because I'm not sure what you mean by moduli here. For this three-pole solution, for this choice of charges, then I agree that there is no moduli. But I've already picked these charges. I can certainly vary these charges to get a different solution. So I consider those to be moduli.
Maybe you said that if you think with another discrete choice of poles, you might have moduli in that example.
Right? Yeah. I mean, what I'm saying is that just for this example, I pick very specific choices of the N's and D's. Right? There's nothing that told me I had to pick those things. So I would argue that those are moduli. I just already fixed them arbitrarily. There's nothing fixing this choice right here. I think it's the simplest example to do on the board, basically.
So this is a good time to ask my Calumet question.
Sure, because that was on my next slide, which is the conclusions in future direction. Okay, so I've already said all this stuff, but in general, these are U1 invariant UPS three charge microstates. So now questions. So I'll get to it in one second, just because I didn't put it in that order. So the first one is, what I mean by how do we invert our conditions? So for a given set of arrangement of two cycles and fluxes, I can very easily read off what the conserved charges and angular momentum are. What I can't do right now is if you give me some conserved charges and angular momenta, I can't tell you all the microstates that I can find for that, because it's just very hard to solve all the conditions and so on. So we'd like to have a way of inverting these conditions. The next one was what you were asking, which is, what are the CFT states for these? How do the CFT encode our microscopic variables? In other words, how do these things like the little d's and the fluxes through them and the arrangements of the two cycles, what are those encoded by on the CFT side? In either the component string language, the D1D5 language, the FP language, I don't care which one you choose to answer it in, but I don't know the answer. Okay, with some modification, you can reduce the four dimensions. So what you basically do to reduce the four dimensions, where the theorist is this. for each of the harmonic functions that I wrote down, in this case, you actually want to work in a different gauge, because you don't want the sum of the d's to be 0, because you can allow for n pi break charge down, things like that. So if I had h, I can add a small constant delta h on, plus what I originally called h, which I'll do this, okay? So this is a constant. And in terms of the n-theory circle, I believe it's something like L squared would be proportional to 1 over delta h. I can't remember if it's L or L squared, but basically look like that. And then each of the other harmonic functions that I had also have to pick up some small constant piece, k will. And what else do I need to do? The little h size. This, by the way, can be interpreted by adding another charge on, basically at infinity. Is if you work out, you can write down like an n infinity and a d infinity and so on. If you work through the algebra for this, you'll find that all these conditions, for example, like this condition will be modified. This condition right here picks up a bunch of pieces. And what I can basically do is I can rewrite this condition as 0 equals the sum of I and Q of dPQ I plus something that looks like the same thing again. This is going to be slightly wrong, but figure out how to do it right. DIPQ, where I'm now allowing Q to be all the things you normally call Q and infinity. Basically, it ends up summing over this effective pole at infinity. And then also, by the way, if I write it this way, this equation is now gauge invariant. Basically, because these DPQs are always gauge invariant quantities. And then you can work through what the other modifications are, too. So basically, that allows me to come back about it 4 dimensions because I'm intelligent. Does that answer your question? Or? So we're working through various details of that. What you'll end up with in 4 dimensions is a 4 charge solution. It'll in general have, it'll be 3 charges and the 4th charge will come from the KK. So you'll end up with some combination, depending on which duality frame you're in, of D2, D0, well, D2, D4, and D6 frame, you know, which is KK charge.
So is tau not, can you really look at tau not like a 2-pole solution or 1-pole?
Yeah.
Do you have a 3-pole version or 1-pole?
We haven't done it yet, but you certainly can do it. I mean, the 2-pole, it's obvious that it's the tau. But I think with some small modification, for example, I just did, you can do the tau not. You have to be able to go careful about the
tau not. Yeah,
you can do multi-sector tau not.
Are the equations a lot messier?
No, they're not. In fact, it basically reduces to...
So from that viewpoint, you could really just look at it as a charge of infinity and it just all follows the same.
The equations are a little bit harder to solve, but not much harder. We just haven't done it yet. But it won't be exactly this example because you have to account for the charge of infinity. Any more questions? I think that was it. So I'd say the last one. Okay. So this other connection. So these people were working in the topological strings have made this really interesting conjecture that the black hole partition function in 4 dimensions is basically the square of the topological partition function when you're appropriate cutting out. So, well, if I can magnify this to 4 dimensions, as he was just saying, these have the potential to be microstates for those black holes. They have the right terms. So it's kind of interesting to ask what the relation is between all these things. And then related to that is because our cycles live in a non-compact space. All this other stuff has dealt with the foam and the compacts and these interesting cycles, basically living in a compact space. So I'm not quite sure what the relation is between that. But I think it's going to be something very interesting. You know, maybe as you go from the black hole to the microstate, some of it bubbles into the non-compact space. I don't know the answer to it. But I think it's interesting to think about. So that's it, I think. Yep. I'm out of slides.
Further questions?
A simple question. It seems to me that you that this program is replacing a single solution that has a horizon and singular by solutions which are solutions of the same theory, but with a different arrangement of things in, inside of what would be the horizon. There are
yeah.
the dipoles and the two cycles.
Mm-hmm.
So one question that, springs to my mind right away is why would the singular solution, which somehow lives next to these all these other solutions,
okay.
why would it encompass all of them in the sense that
so,
the area of its horizon yeah. counts the number of these other solutions?
So that's definitely a very good, very reasonable question. And I can't give you an explicit, definite answer because we haven't found all the microstates yet. I can't tell you all the horizon.
Intuitively, you know, how am I supposed
okay. to Okay, so one way you can see that our horizon emerges, okay, from these geometries mm-hmm. is, let's say I have a cluster of poles that are very close to each other. And please don't ask me specifically what I mean by very close, but let's just say close to each other compared to some other distance, maybe some other pole algebra. Okay? This cluster of poles has some effective total n and some effective total, you know, d, p, q, say.
Right.
I can add up all of these. Right. So let me call this dt and, you know, some of the n's we call n.
Mm-hmm.
Now let me just forget about the fact that really there's a cluster of poles here. Let me just say it's one pole with nt and dt.
Mm-hmm.
And let me ask what geometry I get then.
Mm-hmm.
What you'll find is that in general you get a singular geometry with our horizon. Okay? And the topology of the horizon is again controlled by n. So if nt is 0, what you'll find is that your horizon is s2 cross s1. And if it's nt is not equal to 0, it's basically s3 mod nt. So I don't know what the orbital ones are yet, but this starts to look like a black ring, and it starts to look like a black hole. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can see a singularity and so on. So, of course, this thing is not the whole coarse grating of all of these things, but you start to see this picture emerging of how some of these microstates can actually capture a black ring or a black hole. Now, the question I'm not sure of, and the question I'd like to see answered, that can't be answered in this formalism because it's BDS, is, well, people have very carefully computed the collapse problem, right, and shown that if I have some general ball of dust, it collapses into a black hole. I don't see how to get around that, except maybe string theory gets around it. So it would be interesting, I have no idea how I'd set the problem up, if someone could do a ball of dust and maybe show that it collapses to a microstate geometry. I think we'd go a long way to answering your question.
Yeah.
Another way to see it is you can ask what the general, so let's say I probe one of these microstates, right? What you'll find is, in general, if you probe a microstate with what you think of as a generic probe, like, you know, some scalar field, graviton, something like that, it's relatively low energy. It basically looks like a black hole. You measure the radiation coming out, it looks like Hawking radiation and so on. What various other people have found is only if you probe with a very heavy and almost the right exact state
yeah.
where you see something like a big spike in correlation. So I think that's another way of saying that, well, okay, I don't really have a black hole there, but most experiments I do, it comes out looking like a black hole.
Okay.
So,
but that's definitely not the case for your solution. Right? So if your supergravity solution is very smooth and you know, non-singular, then I don't...
Well, you have to ask how big, you know, these cycles are. And, I mean, I haven't actually computed for you, you know, what happens to a scalar field probing this geometry, right? The question is a scalar field probing this geometry actually sensitive to these two cycles or not? And if they are, at what scale and how long does it take to come back out? Right, because near each of these points, you know, like the near decoupling limit, you find this long, like, ADS3 thread.
Is there a good physical argument why my scalar field should not be sensitive to a large cycle, which has small curvature?
Well, the question is, what do you mean by large? What I'm saying is, I don't know yet if these cycles are large compared to what
string
you think.
Scale.
You know,
for example, front, right?
Well, but the question is, what black hole are they representing? If I'm probing some black hole with near zero horizon area, right, then I would expect string corrections to matter anyway. And so I shouldn't trust my supergravity solution anyway. I mean, we know, for example,
that these four-dimensional black holes that have zero horizon area are corrected to have finite horizon area by string lengths, right?
But I saw that here you have three charges for you. I expect that.
Yeah, so you expect, what I'm saying here is that because I haven't been able to write down the generic microstate yet, I don't know how big these cycles are compared to like the macroscopic horizon size. So if you have to go really far into the macroscopic, you know, if I have to go very far in, it takes me a very long time to get out, say. And when these things scatter, they basically end up with some huge redshift, right? Remember I had this redshift picture? The redshift goes up to some very high value and then cuts off. Well, then if you throw a scalar field in, it's going to almost look like it's going to infinity, but not quite. So you have to be very, very sensitive to measure the fact that it's not going to infinity. That it's something very large, but not infinity, right? Can you consider 10 to 100 infinity or not?
I thought that that computation was explicitly done probably in the D1, D5 system.
It's only done in the two-charge state?
Yeah, two-charge.
And there's certainly no reason why you couldn't do it in our thing. It would just be harder to solve.
But in that case, I can understand why that, because in that case, there are string scale curvatures, right? So the resolution is a string scale. But in your case, when you look at, you are trying to, see, I have a little bit fundamental problem. If you try to describe microstates in a supergravity approximation, and I think one of the ideas of VJ and company was that that the states generic, well, the pure states generically will have large curvatures.
Well, okay, they were looking at a different system.
It's different. But if we go back to, is the two-charge system has a large curvature. And that, in principle, I can understand that, you know, in such setup, the scalar field.
So look, the reason I'm not answering your question, I'm dodging a little bit, is because if you tell me, if you want a black hole with an actual, like, large horizon, I can't, at this point, write down what the generic microstate for it is in our formula. I just don't know what it is yet. I'm not saying it's not there, I just don't know. And so I don't want to give you an answer that 2 months from now could be incorrect. Any answer I give you now is just going to be guessing. And I admit that, and it's unsatisfactory, which is why we're doing it.
I was just thinking that the same explicit example that you had, it's a very good example, and you can start in it. Assume that that's a generic.
But the horizon there is not that, I mean, it's finite, but it's not that large. For the black ring horizon is not, okay, it's not
you're
like a large.
As long as they, so with three poles, they cannot have a macroscopic horizon.
Well, so there's two uses of the word large. Some people use large to mean classically finite.
Yeah,
so in that sense, I would say we have large, but large in the sense that like a large horizon, we haven't found it. No. So I don't know. Is the answer. I think you'd have to go to a much higher pole state to see that, which I think is doable, but then I'd have to figure out what a higher pole state is with all these conditions, and then compute scalar wave scattering in that, which would be difficult, but I think it's doable. So I think it's an open problem.
Yeah, in the topological string business,
yep.
With the black holes and Claudiaus, the microstate picture there, if you take a Claudiaus and graph, say, two brains on two cycles and four brains on four cycles, and if you pick your Claudiaus sort of randomly, like a human will, those tend to have moduli spaces.
Right.
And then you actually can keep a cohomology of the moduli space, and that's supposed to match the entropy.
Yeah, so that's why it's
now, similar. Now, your solutions presumably is either large numbers of balls will also have moduli spaces.
Yes.
Do you have a clean conjecture like that one for what the entropy would be? Do you want to take a cohomology of that moduli space?
No, I don't have a good conjecture of that yet.
And you also have a conjecture on how that moduli space is related to one that comes up in the topological string.
That I definitely do not have a conjecture for. I would be very, very interested to think of a conjecture for that. To be honest, I just started learning about the topological string, and I'm trying to connect it, and it's something we're thinking about. So anything I tell you right now, like I said to him, it's going to be a wild guess. If you want a wild guess, I can give you one, but it's probably not going to be very effective.
What's your
my wild guess?
Go ahead, the microphone.
Well, the problem is, it's something I'm confused about, is as you said, you're summing over different Claudiaus. And here, I mean, there's a little bit of dependence on the Claudiau here. Where is it? My offsets. So you see the Claudiau, and there's a little dependence because these z functions make certain parts of the T2s get bigger or smaller relative to other ones. But that's not the same thing as summing over topological different Claudiaus. So I don't quite know what the relation is between, Because the thing they're doing with topological string is that aren't they counting various, well, they're counting various ways of wrapping the M2s on
the fixed cloud. Yeah, points in the brain moduli space.
Yes, yeah, on the fixed cloud, yeah. So what I would say here is that it's somehow the geometric transition of that.
Yeah, that's what I would have thought too.
That's what I think, but I think it's not completely that. I think there's something else going on. I don't know right now. So I think basically what's going on is, as you just said, and I agree, is that on each of these T2s, you'd think I would have had, you know, the M2 breaks, and you can count how to arrange them. But really what I'm counting is these fluxes and stuff are all actually taken care of. So the different ways of arranging the flux and such like that should give me the different ways. The problem is I don't know what the moduli space is for the fluxes. But somehow that moduli space should match up to the topological string moduli space. But I don't know how to do that yet. That's my wild guess. I don't know how wild that is, but it's a wild guess.
So, did you study the probe brain in your own?
Only at the debate, because we were checking to see if it was an anson. Mm-hmm. And while the tension of an M2 brain probe vanishes there, mm-hmm. What you find is that its potential, if it's moving, doesn't actually, it's not like a repulse on. It just goes right through. It doesn't actually like stop there. Right, if you look at an enhanced on, the way I do the enhanced on calculation is I have some small and non-vanishing, you know, velocity. And I see as it moves through, you know, does it actually get localized on the shell and spread out on the shell or not? And in this case, it doesn't. So that's the only thing we've done a brain probe analysis in. We haven't done a more general analysis. And I agree that it should be done.
Okay, let's postpone for the questions
later. I'll be around all week, so I'm in 461. By all means, come by and chat. I'm more than happy to.
I'm Tom from Asgard.
So a simple one was, why is this asymptotically flat? There was a one.
Remember the topology of the various S3s? Looks like S3 mod NV.
Yeah. Right.
ZMV. And you know, that's how I calculated that.
Okay.
As you go out to infinity, it looks like S3 mod Z N total.
Okay.
Right. And so if n total
okay.
is not 1, I get some orbifold, and therefore it doesn't look